But I had heard, and my agent called and said, you know, they're looking for somebody to announce Wheel of Fortune, and they're excited about you because they know your voice from the radio station where I work, KNX 1070 News Radio.
You're tuning in to Big Guy Small Talk, where we have conversations and not interviews. Although sometimes we do have interviews. Hey, people. Hope you're feeling good today. So today's episode features Jim Thornton, and he does a lot of voice work. You know, he's the voice for Wheel of Fortune. So he's the one greeting you and your families across America every day into that amazing show. I actually met him there on the set, and it was awesome. And then he's worked on projects like Monsters, Inc. He's also on the radio. He's just doing it big, you know. He's living the dream that a lot of people live when they go to LA, which is they want to make it, and he made it in voice. You'll just hear his voice throughout this whole interview. It's amazing. But it's cool because he also talks about how he got started, what got him into voice acting, and then how he was able to just do it. I mean, I think a lot of people want to know what the secret recipe is to making it, and there just isn't one. You have to... I mean, he gives some good tips at the end, and he gives some good tips throughout the interview, but he also just works hard. I mean, he's a hard worker, and he's just generally a happy person. So he was a lot of fun to talk to. It was a good interview. But that's it, man. I'm going to be quiet so you guys can just enjoy the ride. So without further ado, here's Jim Thornton. Well, welcome to Big Guy Small Talk. Happy to have you here, Jim.
Thank you, Ron. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, do you just want to introduce yourself for everybody?
Sure. I'm Jim Thornton. I'm the announcer on the show Wheel of Fortune, which has been watched and loved by many people for a long, long time.
Yeah, and you have the voice for it, man. I remember seeing you, because you don't just do the voice, right? You get the crowd going too, right? That's like part of it.
Yeah, it's not a tough crowd. It's a lot of good people, and yes, I sort of, you know, they're already excited to be there. I hopefully keep that feeling going. So yeah, I warm them up and have a good time.
Yeah, I think you do, man. Whenever I was there watching you, everybody seemed to get really into it. So I think that's cool though. I didn't know they had like someone who got the crowd kind of, you know, into the show.
Yeah. It's neat. I had gone to shows long ago. I'd been to a few tapings, many, many years ago. I went to Johnny Carson, and Ed McMahon did the warm up.
Oh wow!
And I mean, all he had to do was get out there and just sort of say a couple of dumb jokes, and people loved it because it's Ed McMahon. You know, yeah. I'm not Ed McMahon.
Man, so you went to Johnny Carson?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I wow. did. I lived in Burbank when I first moved out here. This is 1984. I was 19. Do the math on that. But and then I Jay Leno. I mean, I was right down the road from NBC Studios, and so I would go there occasionally. I would sneak onto the lot at Warner Brothers Studios, and you know, I didn't cause any trouble. I was just some kid, but I just went in and checked out like the old Western studio, the old sets and everything. It was really cool.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. How was security then? Was it not that tight? Pretty easy to just get on?
You know, nobody. I just would walk through like I was a worker, like I knew going. And there weren't, they didn't do ID badges and stuff like that. Like now they would have, you know, if you were to do a walk-in, whatever, they'd, you know, make you show your ID and stuff. This was pre-9/11, way before 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah, things are different now. I like, just to get on the lot to Sony is a chore, you know.
Yeah, remember we had to run you several times through that metal detector.
Yeah, there were... But no man, what are you drinking there? What kind of beer are you into?
I see you sipping on something. Corona.
Corona.
Corona Familiar. I don't have to work tomorrow, so I might have a beer.
Oh there yeah, you go. It's a good thing to do. Dude, it's a good time for that, man. The summer's finally cooling down a little bit. We're all a little happier now. It's been wild. But so aside from doing the voice on Wheel, like how did you get started doing that, I guess? You know?
on Wheel. I guess I could go kind of backwards because I got the job on Wheel. I got that because my name came up when the producers were looking for somebody to be the replacement, the new announcer for Charlie O'Donnell, who died in 2010, sadly. And he was somebody who I'd listened to for many, many years, you know, and it was I was sad to hear he died. But I had heard, and my agent called and said, you know, they're looking for somebody to announce Wheel of Fortune, and they're excited about you because they know your voice from the radio station where I work, KNX 1070 News Radio. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. Wheel of Fortune knows me. And I had done Price is Right in 2004. A couple of weeks I filled it, or I auditioned in 2004 after Rod Roddy died. And so I'd had some experience, but game shows are something I always wanted to do. You know, one of those things. I wanted to be that Ed McMahon, or I wanted to be an announcer somewhere. I loved the freedom of being sort of not seen necessarily, that's okay, but heard, like a Gary Owens. Like when I was little tiny, I remember laughing. And I, you know, I'm just old enough to remember, and I got to meet Gary Owens at one point, and he was a nice guy. Anyway, but backtracking a little more, I'd worked at the radio station many years. I came out to L.A. because I wanted to be in radio and TV. I moved out here from West Virginia, and that was kind of it, you know. And so I'd worked in radio doing the news radio thing, but also I was a disc jockey. I worked as the announcer for a TV station in Los Angeles for about 4 or 5 years. I'd done country music and all these, you know, different things, and I sang some too early on, but, you know.
Yeah, I remember we talked about that.
You sang a little bit.
So you went to L.A. at, what, 18, you said? 19?
19. I'd had a year at Marshall University in West Virginia in Huntington, where I was raised. And there was a friend who was coming out to L.A., and he said, oh, you got to go out. And I thought, well, I'll give it a whirl. I was working at a TV station in production at the time, you know, just camera, lighting, audio, and stuff like that. Great job for an 18, 19-year-old, you know.
Yeah.
But I had to give it a try, and here I am, you know, 30-plus years later. So.
Wow. What did your parents say whenever you told them you were going to do that?
Oh, my dad thought I was making a mistake. And, you know, and my stepmom, I don't think really remember she had anything to say about it. My mom died when I was 8 years old, so she was, you know, out of the picture, or else things might have been different, you know?
Yeah.
You about that kind of stuff. I was a little kid when my mom died. But my dad thought I was making a mistake. I should finish my college. That's what dads are supposed to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, now he doesn't think I made a mistake. But
yeah, clearly not. No, you built a whole career on your voice, which is pretty, and your work ethic, but... That's pretty amazing. So what were some jobs, because I know now, like, when people go to LA to get discovered or found or do music, you know, they work barista and waiter. That's like the two jobs. And now I guess Uber and Lyft are big. But what were the jobs then that you did to sort of make it by while you were?
Oh, man, every job left a mark. It left a scar that I can rattle them right off for you. When I first came to LA, I thought, oh man, I got to play it safe. I got to get a job. So I went to McDonald's. I thought, if I can't get a job at McDonald's, maybe they're not hiring, but if I can't get a job there, I need to just turn around and go home. I worked at McDonald's for a week. I worked at Taco Bell for a couple of weeks, which was closer in Burbank there on Olive Avenue. And then I worked at the Disney commissary, Disney Studios in Burbank, you know, as like a busboy and stuff. And I did that for maybe a month. I sold office supplies. all this stuff within the succession of like 3 months. I couldn't take the office of selling office supplies. I was on Hollywood Boulevard at the old Stephen J. Cannell building at La Brea and Hollywood up there on like the third floor.
Yeah.
Cold calling people to sell them pens, a gross of pens, the paper-made erasable ink pens that they had in the back of the day. I worked there, and I couldn't take it anymore. I didn't come back after the Christmas holiday, I remember. I worked at a movie theater. Those were my little, you know, they were all pretty much minimum wage jobs, except for the sales job, which paid well, but it was, you know, cold calling people. And then I got into traffic reporting after that. So that was put in the door for broadcasting, I guess. I was off air at first, and then 6 months later, they put me on in 1985, and I was, 20 years old. I wasn't old enough to go and buy a beer. But I was reporting on these freeways that, you know, that I barely knew. I didn't even have I'd just gotten a car at the time, I think. For the first year, I didn't have a car. I sold my car like an idiot. I mean, it was hard times, man. And I had a little blue Honda Civic that my dad had bought me, which was really nice back when I was in college. And I'll just get another car at some point. I'll work hard. And, oh, man, you know, when you don't have a car in L.A., it's bad news.
Yeah, it's definitely not. It's a rough city to get around. That's for sure.
It is.
But what? So you worked all these jobs, and I'm assuming all these like ate a little bit of your soul, just like a little bit at a time. And as you were hustling to do voice, what were you doing at night or in the evenings? Like, were you going out or looking for auditions? Were you networking?
You know,
when you were younger.
I did not have an agent. You need an agent to do auditions usually, you know, and I didn't, I was so green. I didn't really know about that kind of stuff. I just knew that I figured radio was my clearest path to hopefully get something. It was there. It was accessible. And the other stuff was kind of mysterious to me. And I was just a little daunted by the whole, you know, like an acting thing or auditioning thing. Going into an agent. Plus I had a little regionalism. I had a kind of a dialect, you know, West Virginia kind of thing. And so it was real slight, but, you know, it was kind of there a little bit, just a real slight accent.
Yeah.
And that went away on its own because I have an ear for kind of picking up accents. And so luckily the same ear, I guess, let me just sort of lose it, you know?
Right. What kind of accents do you do? I've heard you do a few, but I want to know.
I suppose I could do a sort of a number of them, you know, if you sort of asked me to. I don't really know. I suppose I could do sort of Australian. You know, I've been trying to do this all year, but it hasn't worked out so far. But, you know, and that's sort of an Australian. I don't know.
Yeah.
And of course, I do all the American accents as well. I can do the Southern. And I mean, I guess I could do it in New York as well, you know, if that's what
right.
you're looking
for. Yeah.
But, you know, it's... And Chicago, fan of an accent, right?
Right.
Car over there, yeah, right.
Yeah.
So what that's all about, right? Are you in Chicago?
No.
Well,
Texas.
Yeah. Okay, why did I say... Oh, you said Central Time for some reason, I just thought.
Yeah, CST, Chicago time, right? No,
yeah.
no, man, I'm here
that's
in Dallas right now.
Man.
Yeah. Oh gosh, going to—I think I told you this, but just going to California, just Texas is just not as beautiful as I wish it was, man. California
well,
is gorgeous.
Texas is so diverse. I mean, are you in El Paso? Or are you more like Dallas or Northern?
I'm in Dallas. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It's flat. You know.
Yeah. And it
skyline's
muggy.
Nice. Yeah, it's not the best. It's not the most beautiful place, unfortunately. But it's good people, and I love this state.
Baby. But, co-anchor on KNX is from Dallas. My old co-anchor, Diane Thompson from KNX is
oh, cool.
From good
right
people
on.
From there. Yeah.
Yeah. So you, when you were doing radio, it was like blowing up, right? Like radio really took off kind of in the 80s and 90s, right? Like it made a huge.
Yeah. It changed, you know?
Yeah.
When I was growing up, it was the 70s were kind of a turning point, I think. And I was a kid, and I was just a radio. Oh, man, I just lived and breathed radio growing up, and I listened to it. You know, I didn't know what the picture was across the country at the time. I just knew those guys were stars, those disc jockeys on the radio. And I thought, wow, you can just do this thing. You can express yourself, and you can make jokes and all this, and it's great. And but in the 80s, it started becoming more jukebox, and the programmers really stepped in. There was less talk, more music. It became very competitive. And then, you know, in the 90s, I guess under the Clinton era, we had the duopoly. You know, where one agency, one company could own a lot of different radio or TV stations, and that's changed things even more. So that everything is more like a corporation in terms of the you know, they what's the word? They you know, one company owns
like,
sort of
like
they stream
a
one
conglomerate
jobs. Yeah, stuff is voice tracked now, you know, and have real disc jockeys, and it's a shame because we're losing the identity of 100,000 different cities across the U.S. that used to express themselves through radio, and now you have, you know, the same, I don't know, whatever it happens to be, the syndicated show. Talk radio especially, you know, you have, whether it's, you know, Republican, right-wing, left-wing, liberal, whatever it is, it's coming from somewhere far away. I want to hear the farm report. I want to go and hear what Missy Lou Jenkins is selling that she found in her barn. That, hey, this is for sale, and you know they have some of those shows now, but they're pretty rare. I like the local quality of radio.
I was just talking about this with someone the other day. They mentioned that in the 90s, Clinton signed this bill that basically allowed radio stations. They went public, right? Mm-hmm. And they got bought out by each other and sort of, it's like what you're saying, right? Big companies started owning just all the radio stations. And
yeah, the same company can own what used to be competing radio stations. Case in point is KNX 1070, the station I work for,
mm-hmm.
or was always a CBS rated station. Well, the same company, Westwood One, at one point owned both of us, and we were both in the same building, two news operations side by side, and that's not good competition. You know, we like all the people because we're all the same, you know, we all, you know, worked in the same industry and stuff, but then it was just kind of odd. And the same thing with TV stations, all of them in LA almost are two TV stations paired as one. They don't simulcast, but they're owned by the same people. They have the same rooms, and it equates to fewer jobs because now they can use one person to do both TV stations and that whole thing. And that's where we're going in almost every industry in the country, I think.
Yeah. So then what does that make you think about podcasting? Right? Like your honest opinion, just because you're on a podcast, you can.
I mean, I think the internet is good in that way. Really good, because it allows, like, if I would have had a podcast as a kid growing up or whatever, it allows you to be, you know, to kind of cut your teeth. To be bad, you know, or to be mediocre, if you want to be for a while or whatever, or to be brilliant. And I mean, it's a forum, it's a stage, and that did not exist for people who wanted to do video and audio and get their word out there. They had to go and knock on a bunch of doors, and let some guy in a suit tell them yes or no.
Yeah, you're right.
Like music, like the music industry is exactly that way with YouTube. They, you know, people, anybody can get on there and become a star overnight, or they can just bomb and nobody cares.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's how, like Justin Bieber, he was discovered on YouTube.
Right.
A lot of big YouTubers are discovered, or they go on to do American Idol or something. And
yeah.
It is crazy, but yeah, it's this weird sort of double-edged sword, right? Like you get like, everyone kind of gets a chance, which is awesome. But at the same time, everyone gets a chance, which means
yes,
you have to filter through a lot of garbage to get to good content, you know?
100% right. Yeah, but I think that at our core, that's who we are as people. We want to communicate, you know? And if you want to make a lot of money, man, make a device that allows people to communicate better. And, I mean, you'll see that over and over and over again ever since there's been a way to communicate electronically. Telegraph right on up to where we are now. People got rich doing that. And because people need to talk with each other and communicate, and we want to see other people. It's just the way we're wired as cave people. I always say, you can always break us down to cave people, because we are, we need each other.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you. Yeah. It's almost like, that's what podcasting, that's why people like them, is because they're unfiltered. They're raw. I mean, you have some that are like high production, or like, you know, like you'll see different, like ESPN or whatever will have a podcast now, but for the most part, people like what you were saying, the grungy sort of podcast that just do whatever they want. They're dirtier. They're like not so PC about everything, you know,
because
I think,
absolutely.
Yeah. So then what do you do on your, on your radio station to make it fun? What are some things you try to incorporate just sort of every day? Because, you know, doing that as someone who's loved radio your whole life, I'm assuming it's like a dream job, right? You get to be on radio. So
it is. I enjoy the live part of the radio. It's a little tedious, honestly, when I got to go and I have to put stories together. It can be a little bit time-consuming and tedious to me, personally. But I like the live stuff. You know, I'm anchoring. It's very formatted, but you can, I mean, you're reading stories, you're introducing things, but you can also interject your personality into it and connect with people. I like that. I like to, when I'm on the air, and it took me a while to kind of get there and sort of see it for what really works best, but what works best for me is erasing anything that's between me and the person who's sitting next to me in the car. I'm just sitting there in their car, reading them some stuff. Oh, listen to this. You know, I know you're watching the road right now, but listen to this. This guy up in Northern California just put together this array of satellites that he could use to communicate with extraterrestrial life. It's really cool. He did this on his own. So I just made that story up. But you know what I mean. I'm telling a story. And I want to find the interesting part of it and then not sell it, but just tell a person, you know, this is what's going on. And I mean, yes, there's some official kind of news programming formatics that we follow that sort of keep us above board. So we're not just some guy sitting there, you know, hey, listen to this. You know, there's a little formality. People like that too. But it's I love the communication part of it.
That's awesome. Do you think in general the industry would be better without so many like regulations or things that you have to check, or do you think those help? You know, kind of.
You mean regulations in terms of
like as far as language you can use or things you can say, or without having someone there to sort of check the story you want to run.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we have freedom of speech, you know, and so as far as the checking the stories, you know, we kind of know what to do on our radio station. That's up to the individual radio station, and that's cool. I'm okay with that. You just sort of follow what the program director, you know, their vision, and hopefully they're not too controlling.
Yeah,
we're professionals. We know what to say on the radio, what not to say. As far as like the, you know, seven deadly words you can't say on the radio or whatever, you know, I wouldn't want my kid hearing that stuff. I get right. That, you know, but yeah. At the same time, I really do believe in free speech, and it's one of those few rights that, you know, you really see in stark contrast other countries around the world.
Right.
Especially, you know, run by despots where you get your head cut off or something, you know, or get an arm chopped off. I don't know what for using certain, for saying anything against the government or who knows what. But
yeah.
So I can see I don't like government intervention generally at all. As far as what we do on the air. But, I mean, I think it's all, certainly, if nothing else, a gentleman's agreement that we don't use no-no yeah. on the radio.
Yeah,
that's one thing. I can see that point, but everything else, when it comes to the government running what we do, I don't see the need for that.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely, I think there's going to be a swell soon for smaller radio shows to start coming up, because you're seeing that now, right? Like internet radio is kind of blowing up in some areas, and then I guess like for what you were saying, this desire to know your city, right? Like in Dallas, we have local Dallas radio that I love more than kind of mainstream radio.
It's an interesting thing where we're going with all this, I guess, you know, as far as the where radio is headed. And the internet is, it's the problem with the internet is it's so individual that you don't have one big audience. Now you get all views, so it's a whole different, it's measured a whole different way. It's individual views, but it's a different concept. Now, it's not an inferior concept at all, because if you have 8 million views on Raphael's podcast or you know, audiences, hey guys, or you know, then you're cool, but it's just different because it's not all at once, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So then, moving on from radio, then What do you prefer? Well, I guess not moving on, but do you prefer doing sort of like the in-person where you're with an audience doing the voice of Wheel of Fortune, or do you prefer radio where you get to talk on air to people?
I guess I like them both in their own way. They're both kind of different, but the same. I talk in short bursts when I do the prize giveaways, but I'm talking to one person only there. It's really, I'm focusing on one person who just won that prize, or maybe imaginary who might win that prize. So it's great. I kind of, in a way, I guess, I don't know if I had to pick one, I'd probably pick Wheel of Fortune, but hey, that's my meat and potatoes. No, I love the radio because it's the radio is more like it's long term. You're really sitting there with somebody and really giving them the news.
Yeah, yeah, that's awesome, man. And so then, aside from all of these things that you do, because I'm sure you talk about doing your voice work all the time. Well, before we move on from that, I do have a question. If you had to give anyone who's trying to do voice work just one piece, like one little golden nugget of advice, what would it be? What's like one thing that you've really learned over your career that you think has helped you the most?
I would say know your product. Know what you have to sell, and perfect it. You know, you got to get an agent in voiceover work. So you got to give that agent something they can sell. And I don't mean you need to go out and be a salesperson yourself, but you could be selling your cartoon voice,
you know, your wacky, crazy voice or whatever. Hey, kids, come over here.
Whatever it is, you know, or just commercial kind of work, you know. Let me tell you about this product I just found the other day, you know, or you could, you know, be whatever it is. Your product, go. Do it until you feel like it's marketable. Listen to what other people, what sells, whether it's movies. There are a million different kinds of voiceover stuff. Movies, cartoons, then radio commercials. Those are the big ones. TV commercials. Those are all the big ones, I guess. And just keep working on it. Make your demo. Make that demo. And then get an agent. And then, you know, then be prepared to do lots of auditions if you can get an agent.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've done some big projects, right? Like, you were in Monsters, Inc., which is a big deal.
Yeah, I was the guy who said, "The future is bright at Monsters, Incorporated. We're part of life. We power your car. We warm your home. And make Raphael lots and lots of money for his podcast."
Yes.
So, yeah, I was in that movie. Which was cool. Yeah, I did that, and I did the ride at Disneyland and Disney World and some other stuff, and a little bit of other little things for bonus material for this and that, like the Cars movie and stuff. But I've done a bunch of TV and radio commercials over the years, too, doing various voices. One of the fun ones was I did a Kraft Ranch commercial. This is years ago. This is 2004, but for some reason I just remember it was a TV spot, and it was... I had to talk like a cowboy, and Sam Elliott was a reference on it, and we revved up ranch. We bring you every kind of ranch there is. There's smooth flavor, there's pepper, and there's more, there's cheese ranch, there's all different kinds of ranch. We revved up ranch, you know, it was fun, because it was kind of different, you know, and then, but I've done a bunch of different things. I've done a lot of character announces, you know.
Yeah.
It's like that. Like that kind of Monsters, Inc., but, you know, maybe an old 1930s guy like this, you know. The year was 1934, and we were all there when the Hindenburg exploded. That was 37. But wasn't it? Anyway, yeah, so.
Dark area. Whenever you say Sam Elliott was referenced, what does that mean?
Oh, that's common. Well, because Sam Elliott was, you know, has this sort of accent like this, you know, and that's not like Sam Elliott, but I, you know, it's just,
that's pretty close,
it's
man.
Not like he's a cowboy kind of thing. It's sort of a rough kind of right. You know, lay of the land kind of thing. He's living off the land, and he's out there. He's seen it all, done it all, and that sort of thing. But he's your buddy too. whatever. That was just a thing that I did.
So whenever you do jobs, will people give you a reference like, hey, sound like this person? Or
yeah, sometimes. You know, and what they do for somebody getting into voiceover work, you get an agent first, and you know, you send out all your tapes, hopefully get the agent, then you start getting these auditions. What you see, there are always directions on the top, or little specs or whatever they want to call them, your direction, and they'll tell you a little bit about what to do, and then you just do it the way they want. Occasionally there'll be a voice reference. Sometimes I'll have to do a voice match for something, or a close match if I can. And you do all these things, you know, all these auditions, and occasionally you'll get one. Occasionally. But it's not like you just walk right into it. There's so many people doing it. And honestly, you may be great. And probably 10 of the 100 people who auditioned for whatever part it is could have done it just as well. Maybe 50 people, I don't know.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people competing for the same job, and it's the producers who have to listen to all these different tapes and everything. You know.
Yeah. How long do you practice a voice usually whenever you're learning something that's new?
Oh, right. I when I get an audition, I may, you know, I spend a little bit of time with it. I mean, I can go in if I got to go in 10 minutes and do it. And that's kind of what you do if you go into an agency. I do all these from home, so I have the luxury of a little more time. I may spend an hour, sometimes a little more, depending on, you know, where I want to go with it. That's for an audition.
So if,
when I do, I go in and do it. Boom, you know.
So if you're doing a voiceover for a part where it's something you've never really done, you mm-hmm. spend about an hour, and then you're good.
If I don't have to, but if I have a luxury of time, I usually wind up taking a little extra. Yeah, at least I'd say, yeah, an hour.
That's crazy. That's fast.
We're talking about a 60-second commercial now, and I'll do it a bunch of different times, different ways, and I'll kind of listen to it. That's just me sort of monkeying around. But like I say, for somebody who wants to be in voiceover, Don't get that notion into your head, because if you're in there with somebody else, you want to do it in one take. You want to do the audition in one take. Then let them tell you, let's do it a different way. Let's do it one more time or whatever. But you want to, you know, as much as you can, you want to do it in that first take. But they're people. It's cool if you do another take, but
yeah,
that's just where I am. I don't like to waiting for me. I'm not going to do another take unless they ask me to.
I would just think for people probably starting out, getting something new, they're probably spending days preparing their voice. You know what I mean? Like, if you have to learn maybe like a kind of accent or a sort of way of speak for something, maybe that takes them days versus like an hour. I mean,
part of the fun of it is, you know, we're just playing pretend. It's not brain surgery. And, you know, yes, for certain accents, for certain regional dialects, if you want to become a specialist in that, and there are people who that they specialize in it, but they got to stay up on that, you know. That's a northern Scottish brogue. That's not a southern, you know, whatever it is. And they know all these different dialects and stuff like that. And that's just too much work for me. That, you know. That's why I thank God for Wheel of Fortune. that much work, but it is. It's you know, it's fun. It's the voiceover thing, but it can get to be, you know, when you're doing a lot of auditions, you want to kind of crank through them, and it's hard for me to do that. It's just me. I'm just slower at that stuff and more methodical.
Yeah. But. Well, it sounds like a short amount of time to me, I guess. But when you do voiceover work, have you ever, and maybe when you were younger, been in the situation where they said, hey, we want you for this. You go in, record, and then they end up using someone else to do it?
Yeah.
And so what happens there? Do you still get paid? Do you not get paid?
Oh, like, yeah. Oh, absolutely. If you're in a session, they pay you a session fee, and then there's a use fee.
Okay.
Session, you get paid for going to the studio, and then the use fee is generally a 13-week run, and then that's when that's for letting them air it unlimited for 13 weeks. And then if they do it more, it's another 13 weeks. So, yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
Is that?
How was it the first time you got a paycheck for doing that work?
Like, oh, it's younger. Cool. It was one that aired. It was a spot. It was a commercial. Gosh, it may have been AT&T called Girl Talk or something. And I don't remember, but that was in
I'd just gotten an agent in about the year 2000 or 1999. And, you know, I think I got my SAG card with it as well, which was really neat. But I went through probably 6 weeks with no bookings, I want to say, maybe. And it just seemed like forever. I thought, oh, man, I've got to produce. I was really stressing because I really wanted – I had never had an agent before, and I didn't know what was normal. Well, there are people who go for, you know, a lot longer than that who don't get any jobs.
Right.
But it's it doesn't really cost the agency anything to, you know – If the person's just no good, they'll let them know probably, and I mean, you know, or at least let them go. But
right,
let me go.
yeah. I just always wonder what that's like. If they like, what do they call you up and say, "Hey, we didn't use your voice," or do you just find out when the commercial airs, or do you
you would know because when you get picked for a job. By that point, you've auditioned for it. You've gone all through the process, and they know this is the person. They know you can do it. And I've never had that where they – I've had them go in a different direction, but I knew it wasn't because of, like, my sucky job. It was because, like, specs – they do speculative spots, and you'll know usually going in, you know, if you're not going to be used. But I think I've been – yeah, I've been, you know, I don't want to say cut out of spots, but I think I've done some that where my part didn't get in. But at that point, it wasn't like, you know, everything was resting on that. You're making a few hundred dollars when you do these spots. It's not like, or maybe $1,000, let's say, maybe $1,200 if you're doing really well. This is not like, you know, buying a new house kind of money for a commercial. It's just not. Now, if you get a string of commercials where the real money is, you know, become Flow for Progressive or something, that's not the perfect example, but they're voiceover people like that who they go in. Like I did a series of Cricket wireless commercials a while back, and I did maybe, I don't know, three or four of them. I did TV and radio, and, you know, they had their run, and that was great. But I met Chelsea, the young lady, I think is her name, real sweet. And she's the one who does the Cricket wireless ads. Hardly a household name, but you hear her all the time, and
yeah,
she's just and that's the kind of account that if you land one of those, oh, it's wonderful. It's like a, you know, you're making good money as long as it lasts. It could go away any day though. So
yeah,
it's yeah, not like the streets are paved with gold.
Yeah, you have to hustle all the time, right?
Yeah,
look out finding things,
which is why I'm so thankful for Wheel of Fortune. I don't have to hustle, and I don't like doing something or whatever. I'm very lucky. Lucky that way.
You know, it was cool getting to be there, seeing how everything was done.
Yeah.
You know, that was a cool experience.
Yeah. It's something I think everybody should do. It's, going to a live taping like that, it's a whole different kind of thing. And when you've watched something, as long as Wheel of Fortune has been on, if you've watched something for years like that, to go there, it's like, you know, our executive producer, Harry Friedman, says, it's like meeting old friends for the first time. Yeah. It really is. Because there's Pat, there's Vanna, and there I am in my little box or whatever. But I think it's a great experience for people to come to this show, especially because it's so well run that we generally, I hope we didn't break down for too long when you were there, but I think we generally keep things moving. It's not like other shows where they stop tape and leave people sitting on their keisters for a half hour between shows.
No, it was impressive. I mean, Pat and Vanna would come out and do their thing, and then they'd go backstage. I'm sure they'd prepare, sip some water, and then they'd go out and do it again. And it was it was pretty crazy to see them. They're like machines at this by now. They're just good. It's like they're like on autopilot. You know, they're good.
They're not real. You know that.
Almost, they look the same age. You know, they like don't age, especially Vanna. She doesn't age at all.
They look pretty good. I see them without makeup on. They look good. They
do. No, it was crazy to see how it was weird because it was both like some things were simpler than I imagined, and then some things were just really complicated. You know, some of the camera equipment was just unreal. Seeing the way it worked and how many people it takes to operate like this big camera, you know, that moves around, and I don't know, because I've never done anything with acting, right? I've always lived in math and science. It's like I've always been with that crowd of people. So that's like a whole different world. You know.
I mean there is a place for people like you within the whole family of production as well. I mean, there, you know, we have people from all different backgrounds. But yes, we use real people, which I really like. We could use robotics, we could use all these different things. You know, we use, you know, cameras, I mean. But we have real camera people, which is great. We have Bob Goosey, who holds up the cue cards for Pat and Vanna, and occasionally who cue cards. I mean, that's a throwback, man. The first days of the talkies, you know? I mean, really, it's been around that long, so it's kind of cool. It's not a teleprompter, it's actually cue cards. And so that's neat, but I think.
Is there a reason that you guys won't switch to a teleprompter that you know about?
I don't know. I never asked about it.
Huh.
Maybe I don't want to plant the idea in their head, because I really like Bob.
Right. Well, I guess I just wonder, like, if they do it for the tradition of it, right? Like, enjoy it.
Yeah, it could be. It could be, you know, and I think Harry likes to keep real people on stage and on the set to make it give a human element to it that it has so well. I think, you know.
Yeah, well, it feels really alive, you know, when you're in there. Everyone's moving around, everyone's working, and so I think just even that gets the crowd into it. I don't know. There's just energy sort of all over the place. As opposed to if everything was automated.
Yeah. Right?
Like a live studio audience would just, it wouldn't have that same feel.
No, it wouldn't. No, it'd be strange. It's like having a computer sing you happy birthday at your birthday party. Did I tell you, Raphael? I probably did. And people who are listening to our podcast should know that that's where they did the tornado scene for The Wizard of Oz. I probably mentioned it. I usually try to.
Whoa. In that same studio?
Yeah, Stage 11 at Sony Studios. Used to be MGM. It's been there since the 1920s. That very stage has been there, you know, the whole shell. I mean, everything else inside has been changed out. But it's where they did the tornado scene for The Wizard of Oz. Somewhere over there.
That's a legendary scene.
Yeah. And so there are supposedly names that are written up on some of the beams, the rafters and the joists up there and the superstructure overhead that say dates of like 1929. And like, where did all my money go? It's November 1929. You know? But it's people writing, you know, people writing their names up there, gaffers or people up there, whoever the riggers be up there in the rigging, you know? Yeah. Pretty cool.
That is awesome. So what do you do? I don't know, like, does your family ever realize, like, that you have this voice? Like, is it something they're used to? Is it something the kids liked as children? And as you got older, they were like, okay, I get it. My dad does this voice. You know, what is it? How was that?
Well, I mean, you know, my wife and my son are both used to my voice, and so they don't even think twice about it. You know, and my family in West Virginia and everything, yeah, they're pretty much used to it, but you know, I used to sing, and when I was 16, my voice was pretty resonant, and I could sing like this. You know, I would sing in the church and everything. So they're kind of used to that. It's you know, and now I think they think it's pretty cool, you know, and that my voice is this way or whatever, that, you know, but it's not
right.
My voice is that great. It's just I'm lucky to do what, you know, a lot of guys could do what I do, I think. There are a lot of people out there with these voices. I'm just lucky enough to kind of, you know, put it all together in one package that kind of works, I think, honestly.
Right. And you're from what town? Is it a small town, big, mid?
We're just outside Dirt Holler, West Virginia. It's it's a town of, no, it's called Huntington, and it's a good-sized town. It's like 50,000 people. For West Virginia, that's a pretty good-sized town. You know,
how was it the first time you came back after getting on TV or getting on air, going back to your town?
Well, I mean, it kind of eased into it slowly because I did so much radio and stuff out here in LA, but nobody knew of KNX or the radio station that I work on here. And, you know, that whole thing. But after I got Wheel of Fortune, it changed everything. It wasn't like there was a ticker tape parade, but you know, it was a big deal. I was the, you know, but it's funny. I don't walk down the street and people recognize me because I'm not on camera. But when I got that job, it's all these people who, like, like my parents' friends and everything, especially who were the parents of friends of mine growing up. Let's say they knew me all ever since I was a kid, but they were just kind of, you know, they just really thought it was really cool. They were kind of gaga, and when people find out, they think it's pretty cool. But I don't ever really, you know, go around telling people do so much, but I'm not embarrassed of it.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine, you know, because I'm from a small town also. Well, you know, we're from like the small town in West Texas. Right?
Yeah.
And so anytime someone does something cool, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's always like, oh, well, did you hear about so-and-so? He's out there in LA doing this.
And yeah, for me, that's the kick of it. I was there growing up, and I remember one time we had a couple of soap opera stars come out on the playing field at Marshall University when we were watching a football game, and it was like you'd think that, you know, Roger Daltrey of The Who had just walked out or something. I mean, it was like this big deal, and I remember that, from a town of my size, we don't have that many people who are from Huntington who have kind of gone into something of a national spotlight. And, you know, Peter Marshall, who was the host of Hollywood Squares years ago, is from my hometown. Soupy Sales, who was a guy in, you know, 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, he was a comedian, and he was from there. Some other people, but not that many. And so it's a big deal. It's really cool. And so I get a vicarious thrill of, you know, being able to kind of do that with people and
that's cool.
You know, hopefully shedding the light on our town a little bit.
Yeah. I'm going to take a pretty big hard left turn here, but what kind of music are you into? Is it like classic rock or a little bit of everything?
Yeah, I guess it's mostly classic rock, I guess. I grew up, you know, listening to, I'd listen to James Taylor. You know, my friends and I would listen to a lot of James Taylor. I was a huge Elton John fan growing up. And I mean, I think your musical taste kind of freezes for better or worse, you know. Okay, cue the Cialis commercial. Here we go. You know, as you get older and you just say, I'll listen to some new stuff as well. And I listen to classical, but I like, growing up, gosh, I mean, I used to listen to, I don't know, it wasn't hard rock necessarily, but, like I say, we'd listen to Police. We would listen to, I'd listen to John Denver. My dad used to always listen to that. And I still like me some John Denver, man. Yeah. It's good to be back home again, you know. Some good stuff. But I'll listen to about anything. I don't know, Lynyrd Skynyrd, any of the old stuff. I listen to new stuff, but I don't know who does it. I can't tell you, like, who does what song, and I just kind of listen to it. I listen to a little bit of everything.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, like, doing radio now, what's your opinion on music and the way things are? Do you sort of miss older music, or do you like where music's headed now?
No, I like, I always, you know, what I kind of like is when you really look at who's making the music, and who's doing it, it's really the same thing as it always was. I mean, yeah, we went through a period in the 80s, I know, for example, where there was so much synthesizer crap and this thing, and it's the 70s as well to some extent. Now you see more bands using real instruments again, and I think that's really cool. And you see people going out there, I mean, you know, as far outside, I don't know, Katy Perry, or you see people who are, when they live perform especially, who are going as far outside the box as they can possibly get. But it's still music at its core. It's got a 3-4 beat. It's got a 4-4 beat. Whatever it is, you know, it rhymes. It's still the same way of communicating that it always was. And I kind of like that, you know.
I was talking about this with someone the other day, but vinyl is starting to make like a big comeback. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, I can't imagine why, but people swear that it sounds, you know, richer and all that. With me, I got so sick of queuing up records when I was growing up and putting them on a cassette that I'd get a really high quality TDK and use my friend's stereo at his house. And it's just a lot of work, but Hey, go for it, man.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest, so there's like two, so with the music industry now, right? Everything's on Spotify or iTunes.
Yeah.
And so a big way artists make their sales is by selling merchandise, but then also selling vinyls, right? Because you're not going to buy, hopefully you're not going to buy a CD when you can just download an MP3, right? Because you get the same, that's the same, like literally the same audio file. But I think they said with vinyl, it's more continuous, right? So it's like you're actually getting a continuous sound versus, you know, like a digital file, which is bytes of sound.
A whole bunch of different bytes and bits, megabits or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I mean, the analog is, you know, it really, it's the way music is performed. It's the way you and I would talk if we were sitting next to each other.
Right.
But I don't think the human ear can really tell as much as people think that it can, you know.
So, like a water connoisseur kind of thing, right?
But I totally get it, and I like that. You know, you're getting the real deal when you're listening to something. You know, when the little, I mean, you're not really listening to the real person anyway. You know, whether it's bits per second or it's little bumps on a piece of vinyl, it's still a reproduction, but it's a pretty darn good one.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, it has its the nuances are there, which is really cool.
Yeah. No, I'm excited. I've been considering getting a record player. I don't know if I'm going to do it. We'll see.
Oh, yeah, you should.
I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
Oh, you should. And then when your girlfriend, your wife, or you know, whatever, you picks up a you know, an old 1950s Christmas record or something, you can stick it on and you'll have a place to play it. It won't just be something you hang on the wall. That's what I do. My wife brings home, I mean, she brings home records and we put them on and stuff, and
yeah,
it's kind of cool.
Do you have like a theater room or anything?
Do we what?
Do you have like a theater room or anything, like a room that's designed for where you like decked it out with speakers or anything?
It's our living room. It's not fancy, but yeah, we.
Man, I went to,
you know, what's up? Sometimes I'll dub them over to my, use Pro Tools, and I clean them up and I dub them over to my computer, you know, so.
Okay, I got you. But, yeah, at Best Buy, I went there, and the Bowers & Wilkins speakers, have you ever heard of this brand?
No, I don't think.
So, Bowers & Wilkins makes really high-end speaker systems, almost like Eclipse Audio.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you ever go to Best Buy, go to that audio room.
Yeah.
And just, you can put on whatever you want. You can, like, hey, I want to listen to this song.
Uh-huh.
And cue it up on that Bowers & Wilkins, and it'll change your life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I
love good sounding audio. Ever since I was a kid, I love the high fidelity stuff, you know.
And oh, yeah.
You go in there, and you're absorbed inside of the actual venue, especially if it's a live kind of thing. I remember my dad had a Doobie Brothers, what once were vices are now habits. That album is the Doobie Brothers. It has Blackwater on it, China Grove, you know, and it had a bunch of live songs on it. But it was, but I remember I'd sit between the two speakers. It was an old hi-fi from the 70s, you know, but it worked great. And I remember listening to it and really experiencing stereo for the first time. And, you know, there's nobody else in the house, and I would just turn up the music. I was like 9 years old. It was really cool.
I can imagine like a 9 year old really into music. That's really cool.
Oh yeah. No, it was cool. it was what I did.
No, I feel the same way. There's something about listening to music and doing nothing else. It's very, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's beyond relaxing. I don't know how to put it, you know?
Yeah.
When you can just calm your mind and just relax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And especially if you can do it without the distraction of typing on a computer or whatever people do when you normally listen to it. I'm guilty of that. But the thing is, when you don't have other distractions and you have nothing else to distract you, then you focus on that one thing, like the music or whatever it is that you're doing. I think that's a great thing too, if you can achieve that.
Yeah, I would highly recommend you check those speakers out. Bowers and Wilkins, man. They should sponsor this. Yeah, they should sponsor this podcast.
I will.
Send me a $5,000 speaker, Bowers and Wilkins.
When I went on the 11 o'clock news in Texas, West Texas, the man was found in the Best Buy, would not leave in Burbank. He'll know it was me, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It was something about that experience that I'm like, man, if only these weren't $5,000 or $2,000 a piece. They're expensive, but they're amazing, man. I mean, what they're doing now with audio is, because now even in regular cars that they sell, right, they put like Sony systems in them so everything's just getting a facelift now. It's great.
Yeah, people, but you know, I think there's a certain age range where you really love that audio, and you get a family, and it's like, oh, whatever, man. But yeah, I know that there was a time when I was really into those speakers and stuff, and I wanted to have the best.
What are you getting into these days?
You mean as far as
hobbies, interests?
I stay busy mainly around the house, fixing stuff up. I'm a scuba diver. My son and I are certified scuba divers. We haven't dove for quite a while, and I'm looking at buying some property here in California and other parts of it, and doing different things. I do a lot of fix-ups. We have a house in Ohio, right across the river from where I grew up in West Virginia. It's on the river, and we go there, and I do a lot of fix-ups there and stuff like that. So that's kind of a hobby, I guess. But I like to get out and hike around if I can. Long ago, I used to paint and draw and all that stuff, and I don't do that as much anymore now, but I'm still getting used to this whole, my son is 21 and he's still here, but it's like, you know, becoming a dad, you become all that, and it, you know, so it takes you a while, but you eventually regress to your teenage self, which I'm trying to do. So I'm turning back into a teenager, and I'm trying to do it anyway.
You're in California, man. That's a good place to act like a teenager.
That's true. Get to wherever it is. Yeah, you just got to get through all the traffic to get to the beach, and then you can be a teenager.
Yeah, it's a good place, man. I really liked California. You know, it's a bummer that Texas can't do some of the things California does, especially the marijuana laws in California. They're great.
Yeah.
Hands down the best.
Yeah, that's all legal now, and, for recreational use. Yeah, and it's, it was funny that the government for so long has been controlling a plant that you could grow it, that would grow in your backyard. It's a weed. It's, you know, why they call it a weed. So yeah, it's interesting how that's sort of changed people's. I think the stigma will go away with cannabis.
You know, it's 100%.
Going pretty quickly. It's going away. But I grew up with, you're younger than I am, but I grew up with that stigma of the, you know, the wicked weed and all that. And it was just something that I didn't really do. But, it was when you see that if you get caught with it, with a maybe, you know, an ounce or whatever it was, you're going to jail for 10 years. That's okay. I don't need to do, you know. It really, it makes a stigma. And just because the government says. And so I'm glad that they've, you know, doing whatever they, for people who want to smoke it, you know, good for them.
Yeah, amen, dude. It's, I mean, especially like, because the minute it became legalized, they just started making, like, California makes some crazy stuff, man. They all like gummies, you know, fruit. Oh, yeah. They infuse it in fruit. They infuse it in drinks. It's great.
Yeah.
It's a great place to
be. Yeah, too. Yeah, the THC, they extract it and put it in there, and who knows what they do, you know.
Yeah.
We may have a beer, but, you know, I'm pretty good to go. But, yeah. Yeah, as long as people aren't getting behind the wheel, it's like, but people are grown-ups, and they know not to do that, like they do with liquor and, beer or whatever.
Yeah.
People decide for themselves, right?
Yeah, but then there's, like, this weird subculture coming out of it. So, like, on Netflix, I don't know how much you get on Netflix, but there's a show called Cooking on High. And so it's about people who make food that's, all infused with cannabis. And you would think, like, oh, this is going to be interesting and fun. But the guests that they have on are just stoners, and it's a mess. Like, it is what would happen if stoners had their own TV show. It's just unorganized.
And just, yeah.
it's not great. Like, it's just not a good show.
Interesting. Well, I'll have to check it out. I do Netflix. I just sold my stock today in Netflix, but so that's why if you saw some volatility today on Wall Street, I sold all my shares of Netflix. I did. But if suddenly, you know, the whole market went crazy, it was because of me. Yeah. I do watch, you know, Netflix a lot, but I haven't seen that. So cooking on high.
It's ridiculous. But I look at that like, this is why people think stoners are stupid, because the show. Yeah,
because quite often, too, it's young people who are just kind of, it's all kind of new to them. And being young, having a lot of hormones racing through your body and marijuana, this is what you get when, you know, it all mixes together. I mean, it's just, it's a rite of passage. So you're going to have some of that. But you also have people who are my age and older, maybe, who just want to relax and smoke a doobie. I don't know. Whatever they want.
Yeah. You should watch on YouTube. There are these great videos of, like, grandparents smoking for the first time, or, like, these old men smoking for the first time. It's great. It's great.
It's not what you expect to see. But also, what's funny is, now, I mean, the hippie generation is, you know, getting closer to 80 now.
Yeah.
The people who were the anti-establishment in the 60s, they're getting closer. They're in their 70s, a lot of them, and, you know, 60s and 70s, but the 60s are the very youngest. But that Vietnam War era, you know, my parents' generation and those folks, they're...
getting up there.
The ones who are growing it up in the hills of Humboldt County. And still are, probably.
Yeah. Well, it's nuts, man. But it's been about that time. We got to wrap this up here in a little bit. But is there anything you want the people to know about you that they may not know?
Oh gosh, you know, just that I love what I do, and I love the people who watch Wheel of Fortune. I really do. I hope you got the feeling, Rafaela, when you were there. To me, it's like I had a bunch of people come in from my hometown or my church or my school or some group where I feel really like I've been nurtured by these people, and they're coming in and they're just my friends and they know me and I know them. And it's the same, hopefully, when you turn on the TV and you hear me giving away something really cool. I'm a small part of the show. People turn the sound the hell down. I know that. But they don't. But when they get to hear me, I feel a connection with them, and I just hope they feel that. And Lord, if we have one person left after my endless talking here, who's still with our podcast, God bless you, Tiny Tim.
Yeah, and people, thank you for tuning in. Enjoy your day, and we are out.
Bye!